This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room and we get briefed. So if you really want to know what's going on in the world, then do listen to this podcast. And please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. If you're minded to do so, please recommend us to your friends or anyone really.
Hey everyone, today is my first day back in the office after taking parental leave. It was really special to me to be with Priscilla in August after she was born and to get to take Max on some more adventures.
Breezy, optimistic West Coast stuff from one of the youngest and most powerful CEOs in the world, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. But then he goes on to address something a tad more serious than adventures with his son.
Now, while I was out on leave, I spent a lot of time with our teams on the issue of Russian interference in the US elections.
Mr. Zuckerberg announced that his company would hand over to US investigators more than 3,000 advertisements bought by groups with links to Russia. On this side of the Atlantic, another tech company, Uber, is now in big trouble with Transport for London over its license to operate in the capital. Both cases, and a plethora of others, have raised questions about the way big technology firms operate. Courted by governments, loved by consumers, they arguably bring immeasurable benefits to us in our everyday lives, governments have struggled to keep up with what they're up to. So this week, I'm asking, have the big tech companies gone from being our heroes to being our enemies?
Google took this motto, "Don't be evil," and they essentially think that they can get away with anything because the results will be so awesome that you won't care that they know everything about you and that they're reading your email.
Step into the briefing room and find out. First, technology writer Jamie Bartlett reports on how the tech leviathans of today were created, how they grew, and what that has meant.
Silicon Valley started off really, interestingly enough, as a kind of military place where a lot of amazing technology was developed. But in the 90s, it became a very commercial place, and there was the huge influx of investment money that led indirectly to the tech bubble, the dot-com bubble of the late 1990s. Back then, this was the sound of the future.
What's really incredible about this is that this is day one. This is the very beginning. This is the Kitty Hawk stage of electronic commerce. And the late 20th century is just a great time to be alive.
That was Amazon's founder, Jeff Bezos, reflecting the excitement of the 90s tech boom. But the ambition of the industry wasn't really matched by reality at that stage. Big Tech's attitude to government was encapsulated by the Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, delivered to world leaders at Davos, Switzerland in 1996.
Governments of the industrial world, you wary giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace, the new home of mind. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone.
Someone who was there at the time was Jonathan Taplin. After a music and film career working with this guy,
come gather around people wherever you roam,
and these guys,
they will pay their debt tonight in mean streets.
He turned his mind to technology.
And then I founded the first streaming video on demand company called Entertainer.
He also wrote a critique of Silicon Valley called Move Fast and Break Things. So you crossed over from the creative industries into technology.
Yeah.
And you were involved in sort of the Silicon Valley scene then.
Yeah.
In the 90s. I mean, what was it like back then?
Well, it was very bubbly. You know, there was a lot of money. There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of possibilities of what the internet could be. It wasn't at that point a place where it was dominated by just three companies. It was pretty much the Wild West.
The first really big clash between large tech companies and regulators was in the late 90s, where regulators felt that Microsoft was becoming too big. And in 2000, a US judge ruled that Microsoft was a monopoly that wielded its power to stifle competition. Tom Miller, the Attorney General for Iowa at the time, said that the ruling showed that no company is above the law.
Microsoft, when they were confronted with important and perhaps difficult competition, their resort was to their monopoly. To use that in an illegal way, nobody is above the law, no matter how powerful or how rich or how successful.
Over the last decade or so, I think the direction in Silicon Valley has been towards the concentration of influence and power into really three companies above all: Facebook, Amazon, and Google. The three of those companies have really come to dominate what Silicon Valley is all about. And the tech gods of today are promising us all a brighter future.
Because we can actually give more people a voice.
Well, now we talk about our mission as building community.
Instead of building walls, we can help people build bridges.
For a lot of people, being able to share brings us closer.
We do it one innovation at a time.
The main philosophy of Silicon Valley today is about disruption, so sort of turning up in an industry and completely changing how it operates. And disruption in Silicon Valley is seen as an unmitigated positive force in the world. But of course, disruption does lead, for some people, to very negative outcomes. So industries that are disrupted can often mean people's jobs are lost, stores are shut down, entire industries can almost disappear in the face of disruption. So the last 5 years has seen a bit of a backlash in public opinion about Silicon Valley companies. I think for a very long time, most of us were very excited by these amazing gadgets and tools that we were suddenly all using, and we loved them. But over the last maybe 3 years especially, people have begun to wonder whether they haven't gotten too big, or whether the price of disruption in our economies, even our politics, has become too great. Some of the first skirmishes happened in 2014, when protesters in San Francisco demonstrated over evictions caused by landlords converting buildings to Airbnb units.
We are in the middle of an eviction epidemic in San Francisco, and it is in part because of Airbnb and the so-called sharing economy. We like to call it the selfish economy.
Jonathan Taplin again.
I think that their philosophy has from the beginning been one of, we're going to do what we want to do. I mean, when you think about Uber in London, you know, that was the philosophy that Uber went into London. Who's going to stop us? And that's really the philosophy of Google. Google took this motto, don't be evil, and they essentially think that they can get away with anything because the results will be so awesome that you won't care that they know everything about you and that they're reading your email.
But isn't it the case that, you know, these companies, they're also providing some very good, often very cheap or sometimes free services to people?
Yeah. I mean, look, I use these services. I'm not saying that we have a choice at this point. What I am saying is that the world would be more interesting if there were more competitors in the space.
Well, the fuel for Silicon Valley's growth has been data, the colossal amounts of data that we share all the time about everything we do online. And for these companies, the key to understanding us is collecting that data and then making sense of our behaviours, predicting our behaviours, working out our personality types, because above all, it means they can advertise products to us. And that is the kind of the underlying business model of a lot of these companies. Better and more targeted advertising. And that means more and more data.
The privacy issue is that more and more of your life and your most intimate details are being sucked into these platforms and then using them to sell you stuff. Now, that may be okay, but at some point we have to realize that these things determine how your life is lived. So, you know, a neurobiologist said to me, well, you know that accelerometer in the smartphone that can tell you how many steps you climbed yesterday, it can also tell you if you have Parkinson's disease because the tremors of Parkinson's are very unique.
That sounds like quite a good thing, doesn't it?
Well, maybe it's a good thing, but is somebody going to sell that data to an insurance company or your employer or something? That would seem to me to be your data. You're getting screwed in this equation. And you should get some real value out of this, not just, you know, some more cat videos.
Yeah, I think for a long time, the platform companies, especially Google and Facebook, have always seen themselves as sort of neutral platforms where they are not really responsible for the content that is shared on their sites. And this has caused something of a problem in the fight against terrorism because governments have been saying, we need you to find extremist or terrorist content very quickly and remove it. And for a long time, I think the Silicon Valley giants resisted this, saying that it's not really our problem. We are simply a neutral platform. Actually, over the last couple of years, in response to government pressure, these companies have started to be a bit more proactive in trying to identify and remove terrorist content when asked. The Woolwich attack, when Michael Adebolajo and Michael Adebowale murdered soldier Lee Rigby in the street, intensified the ongoing debate over social media's role in preventing terrorist attacks. It transpired that 5 months before the attack, Michael Adebowale had expressed his intent in a graphic Facebook post. Then Prime Minister David Cameron said social media companies had to do more to stop the spread of extremism.
Their networks are being used to plot murder and mayhem. It is their social responsibility to act on this, and we expect them to live up to that responsibility.
After the Westminster terror attack this year, when Khalid Massoud drove a car across Westminster Bridge, killing 5 people and injuring dozens, the debate over social media's role got louder. The attacker's last message was sent over WhatsApp, which protects the privacy of people's messages using encryption technology. The Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, said that security services should have access to these kinds of encrypted messages.
It used to be that people would steam open envelopes or just listen in on phones when they wanted to find out what people were doing legally through warrantry. But on this situation, we need to make sure that our intelligence services have the ability to get into situations like encrypted WhatsApp.
Over the summer, the EU Commission hit Google with a record fine of £2.1 billion for promoting its own shopping comparison service at the top of search results. Margarete Vestager, the European Union's Competition Commissioner, said this was an abusive practice that was distorting the market.
Google has abused its market dominance as a search engine by giving illegal advantages to another Google product, its shopping comparison service.
In fact, creating a monopoly and crushing competition is seen as a valid ambition by many in Silicon Valley. Here's PayPal's founder, Peter Thiel.
We think of capitalism and competition as synonyms, and I believe they are antonyms. A world of perfect competition is a world where all the profits are competed away. So if you want to compete in a crazy way, you should open a restaurant. You will never make any money doing so. what I think everybody who is a founder or entrepreneur should aim to do is build a monopoly.
Many argue these companies are just too big. Jonathan Taplin is one of them.
These companies were all built by acquisition. And so maybe these companies might have to be split up and YouTube would have to compete against Google. You know, Instagram would have to compete against Facebook as opposed to being part of Facebook. The second thing is the Europeans are going to put through something called GDPR in May of 2018, General Data Privacy Regulation. And essentially that means that the default will be that I have opted out of giving Facebook and Google my data, and I have to positively give them permission to take my data. That would be a profound change in their business model, and I don't think they're, quite frankly, ready to deal with that.
Jonathan Taplin ending that report from Jamie Bartlett. In 2009, at the height of the recession caused by the financial crash, city bigwig and regulator Adair Turner questioned whether much of the city's activities were socially useless and whether some companies had grown beyond a reasonable size. Do the same questions now apply to technology firms such as Amazon, Google, Facebook and Apple? Joining me in the briefing room to discuss this are Eileen Burbidge, Chair of Tech City UK, a government-funded body which aims to boost the UK's digital economy, and Rana Faruha, a columnist for the Financial Times and author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Rana, if I could start with you. It was very well put by a writer in Bloomberg that I was reading, and said the question was, how can these benign, universally loved innovators be stopped from turning into evil, soulless corporate behemoths?
It's already happened. It can't be stopped. No, I'm just kidding. It's a process. I mean, it's been going. If you're talking about the largest tech firms in the world, I think, frankly, it's a bit of a mythology that they've been sort of, you know, Teflon, California hippies, do no evil sort of people, as Google would say, for some time now. You know, I mean, these companies have become the most cash rich, politically powerful, cognitively powerful firms on the face of the earth. And so there's no reason really for us to think that they would be any less rapaciously capitalist than anyone else.
But can't you be a good person with a lot of money and...
Of course you can. Absolutely. But I've been writing a lot of columns about big tech, and what has struck me is that the industry is in many ways similar to the financial industry before 2008. They have a lot of wealth and power. You know, there is a lot of reshaping of our legal system, of our judicial system that's been done by these firms to their own advantage. And it's just really, really important for us to understand what's happening, to understand how they're using our data, how they're commoditizing it, what the economic, political, and social implications of these firms are.
Okay, Eileen Burbidge, companies such as Google and Facebook, as we've heard, have access to a huge amount of consumer data now. And together, between them, they control 85% of the digital advertising market. Should we be worried that these companies are now effectively global monopolies?
I think that being concerned is a good thing. I think worry might be a little bit emotive in that I think, as Rana was pointing out, what's happening now is a reshaping. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that these forces are unprecedented in that we've always had really big behemoth conglomerates, whether it's your General Electrics or even your Microsoft, maybe more recent history. And maybe the biggest concern at that point was monopolistic actions or behavior and anti-competitive nature within a certain sector. And what's unprecedented this time is that these companies are so far reaching. And I think that's the reason why it is worthy of concern. But it's most important that these companies continue to work with regulators who haven't been able to anticipate what might happen just as much as the companies haven't anticipated it themselves either.
What do you say to the suggestion that the value of the data that we give these companies should be in our own hands, that we should get royalties or be able to sell on our own data or just get something for it?
Well, I think you're right that we don't get direct money back from sharing our data or actually giving up our data, as it were. But I think in theory, we're meant to get better consumer services or better offerings and more value from what the companies are giving to us.
Rana, do you see it that way?
Not quite. Let me share some figures from some academic research that's been done recently. So if you just poll, and this is a U.S. audience, but if you poll a group of young people and say, how many of you would be randomly willing to share your email contacts, let's say, in exchange for more relevant advertising services, et cetera, 4/5 of them will say, no, we don't want to share our friends' emails. We don't want to share something even that innocuous. However, if they're nudged with the offer of, say, a free pizza, and this has actually been done in an MIT survey, many of them will say, sure, go ahead and take our email. So this is done all the time. You know, if you kind of do a little mini experiment with it yourself, go online, see how easy it is to click through and how many times you're given these sort of very soft nudges to force you, gently nudge you to give more information. It happens all the time. People don't really understand how that information is being used, how widely it's being used. They certainly don't understand the value of that data in exchange for what they're getting. And I can tell you, it's a heck of a lot more than a pizza.
It is a heck of a lot more than a pizza. But if we don't value it, how could you make a valuation for it?
And if we... Well, because we need transparency, and that's what we don't have. You know, I mean, if you go back to Adam Smith, father of modern capitalism, for markets to work, he believed there needed to be three things in place: equal access to information, transparent prices, and a shared moral framework. And I would argue that none of those things are in play when we're dealing with big tech.
Eileen Burbidge, we're starting to see a more stringent response amongst policymakers to challenge the dominant position of some of these companies. I seem to recall a day not so long ago when we were all falling over ourselves, governments, to get Google or whatever to come into our countries and start up everything and so on. And now the mood music has changed entirely. Do you think that greater regulation, better regulation, is the answer?
Better regulation is definitely part of the answer. I mean, I think the challenge, though, is that all of this is unprecedented. It hasn't happened before. As you say, part of the reason cities, you know, including those in the UK, used to fall over themselves to try and attract these big companies is because they employ a lot of people. They bring a lot of skilled jobs to the market. And I think the other question is when they start offering services that become so ubiquitous and so far-reaching that they also affect labor laws. I mean, look at Uber in London, for example. Then it starts to, take on a whole different type of responsibility. And this is something, yes, I think we need better regulation. That means more informed regulators. And I do think that just means more conversations between these companies and the regulators.
Rana.
So I wanted to just respond to the idea of how many jobs these firms create. The big platform firms, Google, Facebook, even a WhatsApp, you know, something like that, create many, many fewer jobs than even the previous generation of tech firms, and certainly than the big industrial firms of the past.
How could you change that? I mean, that in the past, technologies have always driven out other previous technologies with whatever, largely because customers have chosen to go with them rather than with what existed before. Presumably, you have to work with that somehow rather than simply saying, well, that's dreadful. Somehow we'll stop it.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that the technology itself is dreadful at all. I think our understanding and our regulation of it has been dreadful. I think these firms are probably going to have to be either broken up into divisions that are a bit more manageable or in some way restructured so that we can all share in the value of our data. I'm actually a proponent of people owning some of the economic value of their own data, and that's something that's being discussed by a lot of economists.
One of the things that Eileen Burbidge, that pundits and politicians in the US are talking about, is saying that maybe some of these big tech companies should be regarded in the same way as public utilities like water, electricity and so on, and regulated in that fashion. What are the advantages or disadvantages of that?
I don't think they should be treated the same as public utilities. I do think, however, regulators are hugely uneducated and a bit naive about what's happening. So I do think they need to be more informed. And I do think they need to look at something, as Ron was pointing out, their template has been about antitrust and anti-competitiveness and monopolistic behavior in that way. I think they need to understand that the effects of these tech companies is now much, much further reaching. And I think the regulators just need to start thinking not just in terms of trade and anti-competition in that way, but also about how it's affecting people, social forces. It could be bullying, it could be discrimination, it could be hate crimes. and everything else that's actually coming into play. We haven't even started talking about artificial intelligence, autonomous vehicles, and the impact of the kind of technology that all these companies are also investing in.
Let's deal with that directly in the context, Rana Faruhar, of the Facebook handing over copies of the 3,000 ads it sold to Russia-linked accounts to congressional investigators. Now, the point that Eileen was making before was about anticipation of what was going to happen. She said that the regulators were badly informed. But in this instance, at least, wasn't the problem inherent in the setup that Facebook had? I mean, in other words, wasn't it actually fairly obvious that someone somewhere would do something like this and something could be done to stop it before they did it?
Absolutely. And I would put more blame, frankly, on Facebook for not being more transparent about that than I would on regulators for not catching up with it. Let's look at the comparison again between the financial crisis and big tech. Very similar setup. I mean, you know, you remember pre-2008, banks were trading in these sort of crazy exploding CDOs that brought down the financial system, ricocheting from Iowa to Iceland. Well, you know, their own risk departments didn't understand these products, let alone the regulators. Regulators will always be playing catch-up. That's why you need a lot of transparency, and you need simplicity.
I mean, Babbage, one of the things that could worry somebody who has seen the growth of these firms and these companies and what they had to offer is that you might take action which essentially prevents other people coming into the market or prevents them from developing future products. In other words, that you could, by your reaction, kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
Yes, so absolutely. I mean, and I think you see that. You see some consumer groups taking forward sort of a backlash and deciding to boycott or not use services or go offline or go dark. And so I do think consumers can take control back. But I do agree with Rona's point, which is many of them aren't aware of exactly how much of their data is out there and how much is at risk or sort of what the cost could be.
Eileen Babbage, do you think that the large tech companies have got the message and will themselves take much greater action, not just palliative action, but actually substantial action to solve some of the problems that people are complaining about?
I think they've definitely seen the risks and they understand it's going to impact their stock price and their bottom line if they're not going to be more responsible. You know, the bigger question is if they're going to do enough. And again, perhaps I'm being far too idealistic and forgiving, but I think they didn't know. I mean, they are victims of their success. I genuinely believe they did not start a tech company to be evil, whether they said that as their mantra or not. All of these companies actually started as single function companies. Facebook was genuinely started as a platform to rate how good looking somebody else on campus was. Apple started by selling personal computers. And I do think they have recognized that they have to bear much more responsibility than they've taken in the past. They cannot just hold their hands up and say, we are simply a technology platform and we're enabling free speech or letting people do what they need to do. And I do think they're coming out and doing more.
You know, I'm going to have to disagree with Eileen on this. I've been a business and economic journalist for almost 30 years, and I have never seen an industry that has been in as much of a cognitive bubble as big tech. Even financiers pre-2008 didn't have a sense that, you know, they were doing God's work. And I think that tech firms still have that. It's only just in the last few weeks, really, under tremendous judicial, congressional pressure that they've started to, in tiny ways, reverse. But I don't think that they really understand fundamentally how important these issues are and that the story isn't going away anytime soon.
Well, to sum up, I got out of that, as you will have done, that these are very big, powerful companies and that controlling them takes quite a lot of effort. But the thing that stood out for me in that discussion was that their growth has been unexpected and the areas they've got into have been unexpected and their products have been unexpected. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't anticipate what some of the problems of those products will be, and actually they should be much, much better at anticipating them. And we are right to demand that they should be. My thanks to Jamie Bartlett, Jonathan Taplin, Eileen Burbage and Rana Faruhar. We'll be back at the same time next week. Good night. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by China Collins. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.